British police come under fire for using force against people holding a vigil in London in honor of a woman kidnapped and killed by a police officer. At least 14 protesters and a police officer are killed in Myanmar as protests against the military's seizure of power continue for a 6 week. Anti-racism protesters rally in two U.S. cities to mark 1 year since African-American Breonna Taylor was shot dead in her home by police. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the first story this hour takes us to the UK, where London police have come under fire for restraining and arresting several people at a vigil for a woman who was kidnapped and killed by a police officer. Officers scuffled with protesters after hundreds of people rallied despite coronavirus restrictions. Organizers condemned police actions, saying officers physically manhandled women at the event that was held to call attention to the dangers women face in London. Meanwhile, the Home Secretary and the Mayor of London demanded explanations from police, while Liberal Democrats called for the Metropolitan Police Chief to resign. A London police officer has been charged with kidnapping and murdering Sarah Everett. She disappeared on March the 3rd while walking home from a friend's house. Our correspondent in London, Ahmad Caballo, says UK police have failed both in terms of their response to the Everett vigil and their responsibility to protect young women like her.
Now, around the same time as this tragic case, there was a YouGov poll that said 97% of women, young women, have been harassed in public spaces, 80% of all women. Now, yesterday, there was a vigil in South London, in Clapham. I attended this vigil. It was expected to be a quiet vigil, yet the police used very heavy-handed nature to disperse the vigil, arrested several women, and this has only added to the anger on the ground. Now, the vigil was called off by the British Home Office, and people were advised to stay away. But nonetheless, the way the police reacted was completely disproportionate, particularly considering the sensitivity of this case, as the accused is a sitting Metropolitan Police officer. And many people were shouting at the police officers that were arresting women, arrest your own, i.e. sort out your own institution, which has been accused of two very grievous crimes here. Not only did a city Metropolitan Police officer allegedly kidnap and murder a woman while walking home, but apparently, a couple of days before that, he exposed himself in an indecent way in a McDonald's restaurant. And had he been arrested and charged for that, then Sarah Everard would still be alive today. That's why people are angry.
And scuffles have broken out between Dutch security forces and protesters angry at the government's coronavirus restrictions. The protest was held in The Hague ahead of the upcoming general polls in the Netherlands. The city also saw a climate alert rally. The election for the House of Representatives will be spread out over 3 days, starting on Monday, to avoid crowds at polling stations. On Saturday, the Netherlands reported nearly 6,400 new COVID cases in 24 hours. Now, that was its highest level of daily infection since mid-January. The country has been under lockdown since late January and has so far registered over 1.1 million COVID cases. Crossing over now to Germany, where people there are heading to the polls and regional elections, which are seen as a litmus test for Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservative Party. People are voting in the southwestern states of Baden-Württemberg and Rhineland-Palatinate. Recent polls show that support for Merkel's Christian Democratic Union and its Bavarian sister party, the Christian Social Union, has fallen to around 30%. This is because voters are critical of the government's handling of the coronavirus crisis, including a delayed start to free rapid testing. A face mask corruption scandal also forced three lawmakers to resign. Leaders of the allied parties fear that a loss in regional elections could leave them in opposition at national levels. Let's cross over to Berlin, joined by Christoph Horstall, chairman of the Die Neue Party. Thank you so much for being with us. Well, tell us about the significance of the election right now and the possible results.
Yeah, it seems that the governing Christian Democrats are not faring too well this time. In both states, they tend to be below 30%. That's interesting. People are obviously not very happy with their policies. And this unhappiness comes from two sides. First of all, there are those who are happy with the corona narrative, I would say. But they are criticizing that there's not enough vaccine doses ready and that the mask policy is sometimes shady. As you correctly reported, there have been scandals about members of the parliament earning money with big face mask deals. And those who are not so happy with the government corona narrative, they are opposed at all to the lockdown policies, which they think are unnecessary, and they point to Japan, for example, which comes very well in the economical situation without big lockdown, same as Sweden and other countries. So that makes them unhappy. And for that reason, we have a combined two-sided unhappiness in the most important subject in politics today, that is the corona story. And I think Mrs. Merkel will not fare too well. Problem is, she will leave, or she has left her party top job anyway, and Armin Laschet of North Rhine-Westphalia is now heading the Christian Democrats, the CDU. And that is his first, you know, not so happy event, and he obviously has difficulties to explain.
What do you see this meaning overall in German politics in the near future? Where do you see it going?
Well, it has been forecast that the big parties in the parliament right now, five, that they are not very well, faring as in the past, and that smaller parties will come and challenge the bigger ones. That is something. And there are thoughts underway to, you know, ease up their access to the parliament, but that is not yet decided. That's one part. The other part is that now the election by letters and not entering the hotspots personally is a new trend due to corona. And the problem is that the election fraud is very possible right now due to this system, because the postal voting is not secured at all. It's very easy to make an election fraud, as we had in the USA.
Okay, well, we'll keep our eyes on political events coming up in Germany. Thanks so much for being with us out of Berlin, Mr. Christoph Horstall, chairman of the Neue Party. Moving on to other news this hour, another daily day of protests in Myanmar, where people have held new anti-coup rallies in defiance of a military crackdown. Fourteen protesters and a police officer were killed during the latest protests in the country. Anti-coup demonstrations have been ongoing there since the military seized power on February the 1st. It alleged voter fraud in November elections, which was won by the party of the de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. She has remained in custody since the coup. Protesters want her release and a return to civilian rule. The military has used tear gas and live rounds to quell the protests, killing at least 80 people so far. More than 2,100 have also been detained. Meanwhile, the detention of hundreds of Rohingya refugees in Indian-controlled Jammu and Kashmir has triggered a panic among the destitute community living in India. As Manwar Zaman reports, the rights groups have urged India to halt the move as the community has already fled genocidal violence in their home country, putting their lives in more danger. Here's more from New Delhi.
Refugee camp in the suburbs of New Delhi is gripped in utter panic and despair. After hundreds were rounded last week and detained in Jammu region of Indian-controlled Jammu and Kashmir for possible deportation, according to police and local administration there.
We have no idea of what will happen to us. We are living here peacefully. We will survive on just one meal a day, but we urge the Indian government not to deport us because the military there will kill us. We are thankful to have got shelter in India. At least we are alive.
Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living across different states of India.
Anti-Rohingya sentiments have been rising in India since the emergence of the Hindu nationalist government of the Bharatiya Janata Party in 2014. The ruling party calls the Rohingya people illegal immigrants and a security threat. Many vicious anti-Rohingya campaigns in the Jammu region also called for their expulsion a few years ago, leaving the community in great distress.
Fearing arrest and possible detention, many have gone into hiding, while others are in panic. Activists say it's unfair to detain or deport them, considering the situation in their country.
Already the refugees have started calling me up, and many have already sent me messages on the phone, apprehending danger to themselves and their community. We will take to both national and international campaigning to safeguard the security, dignity, and safety of the Rohingya refugees, as well as all other refugees in India.
Human Rights Watch and other rights groups have urged India to halt any deportation plan, saying conditions in Myanmar are not conducive. They say the Indian government should uphold its international law obligations and protect those in need of refuge within its borders. India has hosted refugees from many countries since decades, but adopted an aggressive approach towards Rohingya Muslims in particular. Munawar Zaman, in the outskirts of New Delhi.
Now to the United States, where Black Lives Matter activists have rallied in the city of Louisville, Kentucky, to mark 1 year since African-American Breonna Taylor was shot dead by police in her home. Protesters held up signs and chanted slogans including "No Justice, No Peace" as they marched through the streets. Taylor's mother was among protesters to demand justice for her daughter. A similar rally was held in New York City, with protesters saying justice has yet to serve 1 year after Breonna's killing. They argued that equity does not exist among American citizens.
It's really important to stand up and have solidarity with the community and say, this is not right. I benefit from the privilege that I have, and I want to change that so that that kind of inequity doesn't exist. I know that if it was me in that apartment, I probably wouldn't have been shot and killed.
The 26-year-old black woman was caught in the crossfire during a police raid on her apartment. Law enforcement officers who were looking for her friend had obtained a controversial no-knock warrant to make a drug-related arrest. The FBI says its probe into the incident has made significant progress. Failure to bring homicide charges against the officers sparked several demonstrations in Louisville. Taylor's death is seen as one of the many cases of police violence and racism, which triggered Black Lives Matter protests in the U.S. and other countries last year. An Iranian judiciary official has blasted the U.S. and its European allies for flagrant and wholesale violations of the rights of the Iranian nation. The Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights said the U.S. and its allies have an atrocious record in breaching Iranians' rights. Ali Bagheri Khani added that these countries have used international organizations to act against Iran with maximum force. He pointed to the sanctions imposed by the U.S. on Iran, saying Washington has taken hostage the livelihood of the Iranian nation to make them give up their inalienable rights. Khani noted that European countries are accomplices to U.S. crimes by implementing sanctions on Iran. Now to Yemen, where the Yemen's bloc of anti-aggression parties has held a political event in the capital, Sana'a, to discuss the danger of extremist organizations. Participants said things are worsened by the presence of Saudi and Emirati forces, which support the terrorists in the south of Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports.
Yemen's bloc of anti-aggression parties has held a symposium in the capital Sana'a to discuss the repercussions of the Takfiri organization's presence in the country. It comes as the army pushes its offensive to liberate the province of Marib from terrorist groups.
This event is to inform the Yemenis of the danger of the foreign presence and terrorist organizations, especially in the southern governorates, and it coincides with the continuing battle of Marib, which has led to mass flight of terrorists from areas previously controlled by Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
The participants in the symposium said foreign forces, including those of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, are the main supporters of the terrorists in different parts of the country. The participants called for purging Marib from Takfiri terrorists.
Everyone knows that the terrorism in the Arab world is rooted in the Wahhabi ideology and is waged with the support of Saudi Arabia. The country is still the center of terrorism, and other countries have joined it, trying to spread these ideas among Muslims. The U.S. and Britain are sponsoring these terrorists and exploiting them against axes of resistance to spread chaos in countries which oppose U.S. policies in the region.
Saudi Arabia has led a U.S.-backed aggression on Yemen since the beginning of 2015 that has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis and has also unleashed terrorists backed by Riyadh and its allies on the war-torn country. Yemenis believe that Riyadh wants to keep a hand on oil-rich provinces of their country, especially Marib. They say Saudis are advancing their agenda by backing terrorist groups with money and weapons. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
And with that, it brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
10 minutes.
Operating in the shadows, Sheikh Tahnoon bin Zayed Al Nahyan is one of the most influential figures in the United Arab Emirates. The major negotiator behind normalizing ties with the Israeli regime, Sheikh Tahnoon is representative of younger royals who have come to the fore over the past decade thanks to their inherited power and health. Tahnoon is the UAE's national security advisor, involved in many opaque businesses in the key areas of trade and security. In fact, he epitomizes the confluence of absolute power and money in the UAE ruling family and the concomitant corruption. A full brother of Abu Dhabi's crown prince, Sheikh Tahnoon was named in January this year chair of Group 42, an artificial intelligence company based in Abu Dhabi. He's also chairman of First Abu Dhabi Bank, the country's biggest lender. Tahnoon also chairs ADQ, one of the Emirates' most active investors. He is also head of International Holding Company, another conglomerate with assets of about $4 billion in 2020, and Royal Group, another multinational conglomerate.
This is not a constitutional monarchy, this is an absolute monarchy. It wields control over every aspect of life in the UAE, and the people there are, as I say, are vulnerable to the whims and fancies of these individuals. There are no state structures, there's no organization, there's no social organization, as people in the West would understand it. It's ruled by diktat, at the whims and fancies of these absolutists, decadent rulers. And it's a disgrace that it's allowed to occur in the 21st century in any part of the world, never mind the Middle East. And so, as I say, it's a consequence of these Gulf states, which live on oil revenues. The UAE also has large revenues based on its development of Dubai as an international tourist resort, a fleshpot, as you will, where hedonism reigns, where there's slave labour at one end of the spectrum and there's decadent luxury at the other end of the spectrum.
Tahnoon's numerous positions in vital sectors reveals the inner workings of Abu Dhabi's absolute monarchy, where the royals dominate key parts of the economy, blurring the lines between state and private enterprise. In the words of Kirsten Fontenrose, director of Scowcroft Middle East Security Initiative, Sheikh Tahnoon oversees everything. He's the trusted under-the-radar guy. Part of that is mystique. He is quiet, and he's always everywhere. The increased presence of the royal family, however, has been to the detriment of the private sector, which cannot burgeon in an economy practically monopolized by the court.
These Gulf states, including the UAE, these are not real states. These are family businesses masquerading as such. And they're run by diktat, by royal families who are unaccountable to any other entity. They do what they wish. They have absolute power over the people they rule over.
An expat executive with years of experience in Abu Dhabi told Financial Times, on condition of anonymity, "Don't think there are any credible private sector players in strategic sectors. If you wanted to negotiate a commercial deal with the family, not at the palace, you would approach through Tahnoon." Whereas the border between the state and royal interests have always been blurred in the Persian Gulf countries, particularly in the UAE and Saudi Arabia, the new thing is the rising leaderships in the two countries are becoming more autocratic and more centralized, disturbing the power balance even among the royal families themselves. According to Stefan Hertog of the London School of Economics, it's a bit like the new generation of royals in Saudi Arabia, who are all sidekicks of Prince Mohammed bin Salman, its centralization being deployed more as a tool of the leader rather than the amorphous block that you had before.
The UAE is one of the most corrupt Gulf states around, if not the most corrupt. The focus is always on Saudi Arabia, but the UAE has become the rest home for international criminals. It used to be the Costa del Sol in southern Spain. Now it's the United Arab Emirates, because these people bring in money and they're able to reside there and they're able to operate from there almost with impunity. And this is a big, big problem, because some of these criminals are responsible for murder and mayhem on the streets of cities like Dublin, London and so forth. And the UAE is tarnished with this corruption. And corruption eventually eats the corrupt. And that's what I think may well happen in the case of this individual and indeed in the case of the royal family of the United Arab Emirates.
Sheikh Tahnoun was born on December 4, 1969, as one of six full brothers who were the sons of Sheikh Zayed bin Sultan Al Nahyan and his third wife, Sheikha Fatima. He is a martial arts expert, avid cyclist, runner, and a keen chess player. In 1992, Tahnoun set up First Gulf Bank when he was only 23. In 2013, he was appointed Deputy National Security Advisor and promoted to National Security Advisor in 2016. In 2020, the Prince was appointed to the Board of Supreme Council for Financial and Economic Affairs.
So this gentleman is obviously a key player. He's obviously been given license to run the affairs of the UAE all over the world. And as I say, it's very corrupting and it's very corrosive. And the UAE will suffer going forward as a society, because no country can stand for long under diktat. There has to be accountability in the affairs of any nation state if it is to take its proper place in the modern world.
Sheikh Tahnoun is said to be a huge believer and investor in high tech, regarding it as a way of diversifying the country's oil-based economy. But his love for technology has a dark side as well. For example, his Group 42 company is accused of releasing TalkTalk, a free messaging app for the main purpose of spying on its users, including journalists and dissidents, according to a New York Times report published in 2019.
Well, that's what these people do. They fear the people they rule over, because they know that they're operating a system that's rooted in injustice and is rooted in oppression. So they fear their own people. They fear their own people will wake up to their condition and they will act accordingly. This is why they expend and exert so much energy and money and time in surveilling their own people, because they're scared of the consequences of their people awaking, as I say, to the reality of the condition in which they live.
The second most influential man in Abu Dhabi, as he is usually referred to, Sheikh Tahnoun, is a constant reminder that there is not enough room for everybody in the major sectors of a country that claims to be the most progressive in the Middle East.
The problem really is not so much how much power he has or whether he's a typical prince. The problem is that there are such things as princes in these Gulf states. That's the problem. This is a regressive and archaic concept, having a prince, having a royal family, and certainly a royal family with absolute powers. It is not compatible with the modern world. It is not up to meeting the challenges of the 21st century. And the sooner that they are consigned to the dustbin of history, the concept of princes and royal families, the better off the people living there will be, the better off the region will be, and the better off, ultimately, the entire world will be.
The lack of democracy and equal opportunities are all too visible in the titles and positions the middle-aged prince holds, all away from the prying eyes. But will he remain Superman forever?
Oh,
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back. We met Javad Qarai, an enthusiastic young nature explorer, and followed him as he discovered some of Iran's most unspoiled natural attractions in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. We visited the exotic Martian mountains with their peculiar shapes and ventured deep into the intertwining and spiral cave of the region. And finally, we joined Javad as he gazed into the mesmerizing waters of the Sea of Oman above the rocky cliffs. Stay with us as we further explore the wonders of the region and meet the kind-hearted locals.
The area is so beautiful and unspoiled. It is home to large flocks of birds, such as the cormorant sitting on the sandy beaches offering a scenic spectacle. It is the perfect place for bird watchers to come and feast their eyes on these exotic animals. Bird watching is a branch of tourism, or to be exact, ecotourism. Bird watchers are steadily growing in number. Cormorants are aquatic birds. They are medium to large in size, with a body weight in the range of 0.35 to 5 kilograms and a wingspan of 45 to 100 centimeters. The majority of the species have dark feathers. They are excellent divers, and underwater, they propel themselves with their feet with help from their wings. Some cormorant species have been found to dive as deep as 45 meters. Cormorants nest in colonies around the shore, on trees, islets, or cliffs. They are coastal rather than oceanic birds, and some have colonized inland waters. Indeed, the original ancestor of cormorants seems to have been a freshwater bird. In my previous trips here, I saw large flocks of these beautiful birds here in this season. But this time, there aren't so many of them. One of the reasons behind the decline in their populations is because some of the locals hunt and eat them. Although cormorants are not supposed to be eaten because they are carnivorous. According to some religious scholars, flesh-eating birds are not to be eaten. The flesh of carnivorous birds may contain many diseases that can be passed on to humans if eaten. But the locals are not aware of that. Those who hunt the cormorants do not do so because there is nothing else to eat, so they have no reason to kill and consume so many of these poor birds and do irreparable damage to the wildlife and environment in the region. The environment and wildlife are manifestations of God's beauty. How can humans, who consider themselves the greatest of creations, allow themselves to harm the manifestations of God's beauty? Human survival on the planet Earth inevitably depends on the environment and on the wildlife. Therefore, our country's officials should educate the local populations and make sure that the environment in each and every part of the country is well taken care of. This has been a very beautiful day for me. Berries is one of the most beautiful places I have visited, and I have visited many over the years. A day later, I'm on my way to a beautiful village in the heart of nature, accompanied by my good friend, Sheer Muhammad Rahul. To get to Shame Kohne, that's the name of the village, we have to walk a relatively long way surrounded by beautiful natural beauties. Near the village, we run into a shepherd named Shir Muhammad, sitting under an old leafless tree by a pond. His is the simplest of lifestyles. The Baluch mainly speak the Baluchi language, a branch of northwestern Iranian languages. Experts say the Baluch language is very similar to that of the Medes, a people of Indo-Iranian origin who inhabited the western and northwestern portion of present-day Iran. And that is a testimony to the deep roots of the Baluch tribe in Iran. Today, the Baluch people live in the southwest of Iran, the south of Pakistan, Afghanistan, Oman, India, the UAE, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Zanzibar. Borders between countries haven't been able to separate members of this ancient Iranian tribe. Although they live in different countries, the Baluch have preserved their traditions. They pay each other visits, and intertribal marriages are common. The Shahnameh and several other old books have placed the dwelling place of the Baluch people at around the north of modern-day Khorasan province. For various reasons, this peace-loving, serene tribe have had to move here, the southeast of Iran, and lived in peace since. Shir Muhammad Baluch is one of the original members of the old Sham village. But today, the village is nothing more than a collection of abandoned buildings where he can rest during sizzling hot days. This is amazing. They place one lantern and both families lift under the light of that one lantern. There isn't much left of the old Sham village, but even the ruins of it speak of the very rich culture of the kind, hospitable Baluch people. One of the structures that has stood the test of time is the beautiful mosque of Old Sham, built by the very hands of those who inhabited the village many years ago. It's gotten unbearably hot by now. I am kilometers away from the coast of the Sea of Oman in Baluchistan. But that distance is not going to keep me from a much-needed dive on the golden sand beach. The difference between the temperatures in Iran's climate zones is incredible, and to many, unbelievable. I'm in the southeasternmost part of Iran, swimming in the Sea of Oman in the middle of winter. On this same day, some of my mountaineer friends climbing up Mount Damavand tell me the temperature where they are is around minus 30 degrees. That's a difference of 60 degrees between two areas of Iran. I've done my swimming, and now I've decided to travel to the southeastern end of Iranian territory. That's the Gwadar Bay, located in the Gulf of Oman on the maritime border of Iran and Pakistan. A lot of fish is caught and brought to shore here. Many large trawler launches unload their catches on smaller boats on the shore. Before they arrive in Iranian territory, the fish coming from those launches are purchased by middlemen and transported to big cities around the country. The main purpose of my trip to Gwadar Bay is to see the beautiful Hara mangrove forest in this border area. Hara is a species of the Lantana genus. The seeds from the tree fall into the water, where wave action takes them to more stationary parts of the sea. The Hara seeds become fixed in the soil layers of the sea and grow. Hara trees are saltwater plants that are often submerged at high tide. They are salt-tolerant trees and are adapted to life in harsh coastal conditions. They contain a complex salt filtration system and a complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. They are adapted to the low oxygen conditions of waterlogged mud. We are now exactly at the mouth of Khur-e Bahu. This is the zero point that separates Iran from Pakistan. We are about to enter a very beautiful river. As a matter of fact, it's a khur or firth. It's not a river. And it continues a long way in that direction. Khur-e Bahu is in fact a bay area created by water from the Sea of Oman. This is the last spot before you actually arrive in the sea itself. Before the firth, there is the Bahu Kalat River that flows from Sarbaz Mountains to the Gulf of Oman. This is it. I can see the mountains of Pakistan vividly from here. Pakistan is located right on the other side of the Hara Forest. A lot of birds and fish live here in this firth, which, as I said, was created by salty waters from the Sea of Oman. It's a very beautiful area. The Hara forests spanning this area are indeed unique. The Hara tree grows to heights of 6 meters and has bright green leaves and twigs. It is a species of the mangrove tree that can grow in coastal saline or brackish water. They have a complex salt filtration system and complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. The Hara excludes salt by having significantly impermeable roots, which are highly impregnated with suberin, acting as an ultrafiltration mechanism to exclude sodium salts from the rest of the plant. Hara trees grow in 8 protected areas in Iran and are fortunately looked after by both the authorities and people. The Hara forests in the south of Iran are a major habitat for migratory birds in the cold season and for reptiles, fish, and varieties of bivalves. Green or hooked turtles and venomous aquatic snakes are also indigenous to the forests. Bird life includes herons, flamingos, pelicans, and angler eagles. Another important feature of these forests is the appropriate and suitable seabed conditions for the ovulation of fish in the Persian Gulf. The locals say you are very likely to run into a school of dolphins passing Gwadar Bay on your way to see the Hara forests. But looks like I'm down on my luck today. There are still many villages in Baluchistan that have weathered the storm of time and preserved their traditional look. But the way to visit one of them is to seek guidance from a local guide. And that person is none other than my very own friend, Shir Muhammad. We have a long way ahead of us to the village we have decided to visit. To get there, we have to drive on a vast plain. There are no paved roads, not so much as a dirt track. The name of the village is Nilak. Baluchistan is a very dry province. It rains very little here. As a result, not very long ago, the people of Baluchistan would dig a catchment to accumulate what little rainwater that fell from the sky. Those catchments acted as their only water reservoirs. They called them hotags. The importance of drinking water is not lost on anyone nowadays. Aware of the shortage of this vital liquid, countries around the world have embarked on preserving and conserving drinking water in recent years. The best way to prevent water from going to waste in a country like Iran that's facing a severe water problem is changing the consumption pattern. Put it simply, every human being needs only 10 liters of water to wash their whole body. But most of us keep the water running while having a shower and let something between 100 and 200 liters of precious drinking water go into the septic tank. Nowadays, most of us think that to keep our yards clean, we have to wash them with tap water every week. While in the past, although the problem of water was not as serious in Iran as it is now, and the population was not as big, people would clean their yards with sprinkles of water and a broom. And the purpose was to prevent dust from rising when sweeping. In the past, there weren't as many cars that needed to be washed with drinking water every few days. But today, millions of liters of water is consumed every year to wash the millions of vehicles across the country. I came to realize the importance of drinking water in recent years. On one of my trips to this same Baluchistan region, I ended up bathing with only 3 liters of water after going without a wash for a whole week. It was a time when the people here were grappling with a drought. That incident led me to understand the importance of drinking water in Iran. I now understand why we shouldn't let even a single drop of it go to waste. This is one of the oldest houses in this whole area. In this whole village. And Haji Khodabakhsh was in fact born in this same house. He's giving me a tour of the interior. The houses in the village of Nilag are beautiful and traditional. But there is one house in this village that is very old, very beautiful, and unique. In Baluchi language, this house is called a kud. It is dark in the house. There is no electricity, no running water, and not even a room. This is all there is to it. The owner says that all the members of the family, and there were 9 of them, used to live together in this house that is no more than one big lounge. But despite all the deprivations, the members of the family are as close as ever. The Baluch are a very kind, family-loving people. I feel an eerie feeling of calm among these pure souls. Baluch hospitality makes any stranger visiting these parts feel at home in their houses. You feel like you were born and raised in one of these houses and lived a good, simple life growing up with these genial and warm people. Most of the Baluch people who don't go fishing at sea are herders, and in this area, camels are the best livestock to keep. Camels have adapted very well to the environment and climate of Baluchistan. My journey is coming to an end. Sheer Muhammad tells me about one of his friends. Mr. Shah Bash is one of the main camel herders in the region. The old camel rider tells me about Baluch kindness towards all of the world's creatures. Kindness embedded in the culture of this people. The Baluch are a very kind and passionate people. traits that are evident in the words of Mr. Shahbakhsh. When I ask him if he has ever tried camel meat, he says the Baluch normally do not eat camel. That's because camels are loved by these people, and so they don't have the heart to slaughter them, much less eat their meat. I have arrived at the end of my trip, a trip that taught me many valuable lessons about the Baluch people and Baluchistan. This is a province with a beautiful, unspoiled environment, a place where the sea meets the mountains and plains. The Baluch people, with their rich ancient culture, are a source of great pride for Iran. I, too, am proud of these honest, kind people, proud of having such generous fellow countrymen and women. The Sea of Oman looks like a drop of water against the unfathomable hearts of these people. All I want for the people here is proper, stable jobs compatible with their culture and environment, created by competent and caring government officials. I hope for facilities and development to come to this part of my country without doing any damage to its ancient culture and pristine environment.
Well, perhaps Iran's internationally renowned mosques and ancient remnants of Isfahan and Shiraz are what attracts most visitors from far and wide, but I'm sure many nature-loving individuals have become interested in visiting Iran's southernmost region and the pristine natural wonders of Sistan and Baluchistan. And that's it for this week, everyone. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.